Hello, welcome to Health Chat. I'm Lina Armoudou. Zimbabwe has launched an emergency polio vaccination campaign to contain a new outbreak, even as it fights a cholera outbreak that has claimed close to 500 lives. Columbus Maguga reports from Harare.
Evan Zwaki, who delivered her fifth child at Chitungiza Hospital just outside Harare, says the newborn has already been vaccinated against the polio virus. Zimbabwe launched an emergency polio vaccination drive after health officials confirmed a case late last year.
Saka ndikunzwa kufara kuti zvangoitika chirongwa chacho tiri muno muchipatara.
Joaki says, I am happy that the vaccination program happened when I was here at the hospital. If you are home, you procrastinate and the vaccination program ends. The United Nations says Zimbabwe is one of the 11 countries in Eastern and Southern African countries that has reported cases of polio, resulting in this mass vaccination campaign. Zimbabwe is partnering with UNICEF and World Health Organization and others on the drive. Dr. Paul Ngwakum is regional advisor for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa.
Currently, Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe recorded over 15 cases of polio since last year, there is a campaign going on targeting 4.2 million children under the age of 10. And again, UNICEF is working with partners to be able to ensure that this vaccination goes on well. A procurement of over 10.5 million doses of vaccines. And we hope by the end of these two rounds, all the target population will be reached.
Sleiman Timios Kwidini, Zimbabwe's deputy health and childcare minister, says laboratory tests confirmed the presence of the virus in samples collected from sewage sites in Harare. Another case was confirmed about a three-hour drive from Harare.
The detection of these viruses in the environment of or in humans constitutes a polio outbreak in the country. While the news is concerning, we as ministry would like to reassure the public that we have taken the swift action to investigate and contain the outbreak to prevent any further spread that may occur.
Quidini urged citizens to cooperate with authorities conducting polio vaccination so that the virus can be eradicated from Zimbabwe. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe is battling to contain another outbreak of cholera with 470 deaths out of more than 25,000 suspected cases of the waterborne disease. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Chitungwiza, Zimbabwe.
Many children in sub-Saharan Africa suffer from malnutrition and are in dire need of help to save their lives due to displacement. Moki Edwin Kinzega has more.
Health workers and humanitarian agencies say the lives of more than 3.5 million children, many displaced from places like Sudan and other conflict-ridden countries, are threatened by chronic malnutrition. They say the issue is compounded by climate shocks that make food and safe water increasingly scarce in sub-Saharan Africa. Simeon Nanama is UNICEF's regional nutrition advisor for West and Central Africa. Nanama says all United Nations agencies are very worried that several million children suffering from acute malnutrition in sub-Saharan Africa risk dying before they celebrate their fifth birthday. He says close to 7 million children affected by acute malnutrition are in dire need of help to save their lives. In December, officials in Cameroon pointed to the mass immigration of women and children into Cameroon seeking to escape Boko Haram terrorists and other communal violence. Boko Haram operates in countries that include Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. He said many of these women and children are malnourished, with scores dying every month. Last week, Chad's president, Mohamed Idris Deby, declared a food and nutritional emergency throughout the Central African state. Deby pleaded for international support, especially for children under the age of 5, whom he said were suffering from acute malnutrition. The United Nations says malnutrition is the second leading cause of death among children after malaria in sub-Saharan African countries. The Douala meeting aims to update health and humanitarian workers on United Nations guidelines issued back in December about how to prevent and manage acute malnutrition to save the lives of millions of malnourished children. Letitia Odrago-Gema, World Health Organization consultant and former public health nutrition and research expert with WHO's Africa region, is taking part in the meeting.
For the first time, WHO is providing guidance on how to prevent malnutrition. And also for the first time, we have guidance on how to detect earlier those children that are at risk of poor growth and development.
Odrago said the new plan envisages more integration of nutrition services into health systems in addressing acute malnutrition. The UN has said it intends to give more food and health assistance to the governments of countries that are most unable to care for malnourished children. The UN has a goal of eliminating acute malnutrition by 2030. The UN says the plan faces serious challenges as the proportion of children with acute malnutrition persists at what it calls worrying levels. It says at least 216 million African children still suffer from stunting and malnutrition. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
We turn now to universal health coverage. According to the World Health Organization, universal health coverage will enable all people to have access to the full range of health services they need, including prevention, treatment, and rehabilitative care when and where they need them without suffering financial hardship. Achieving universal health coverage is one of the targets set by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals number 3. A conference is taking place in Abuja, Nigeria from February 27 to 29 to discuss how the faith sector is contributing in helping communities and individuals access universal health care. Joining us live from Abuja, Nigeria for more insight is Dr. Dennis Chirian, who is attending the conference. He is Vice President of Chorus International for Health, Nutrition and Wash, Water, Sanitation and Hygiene. Dr. Chirian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So you are attending the 11th biennial conference of the Africa Christian Health Association platform. What are some of the key highlights on the agenda?
Thank you so much. The conference is focused on the agenda to learn how are we advancing universal healthcare coverage and what is the role of faith-based organizations. This is looking at equity, how do we put policy into practice, looking at how do we work with local partners and strengthen the capacity to bring local solutions to advance universal health coverage, supply chain issues, and building resilient health systems, especially given that the context that we work in is a lot of fragility and conflict, post-conflict settings where majority of the population live and are struggling on a day-to-day basis to access quality health care.
So when we hear universal health coverage, yes, I explained earlier, according to the World Health Organization, what it means, access to full range of health services. But when we take it to the ground, when we take it to communities, to that person in the rural area, what does it really mean when we talk about universal health coverage?
It means that every individual, irrespective of where they live or the context that they live in or their background, each and everyone has the right to good health care, quality health care, that the burden to accessing health care is reduced, whether it's due to financial barriers or geographical access. And to do that, primary health care is what is most critical. And investing in primary health care help advance universal health coverage.
How so?
Well, the World Health Organization says that universal health coverage can be achieved with 90% primary health care access. In other words, primary health care is the foundation where everybody has access to health care. It's the first point of contact. And therefore, if the primary health care system is strengthened, which is fundamental to strengthening health system, then we are talking about everybody having access to equitable health care, where health care services are offered free of care, or they have other social schemes that enable them to access health care services free of care. But also it speaks about respectful care, where mothers who bring the children are treated respectfully and the client-provider trusted relationship is further enhanced. It's looking at a more comprehensive care that looks all the way from prevention to promotion, treatment, rehabilitation, but also looks at what are the demand-side barriers that needs to be addressed to increase access to healthcare. This means that one has to work not just within the healthcare system, but beyond the healthcare system, looking at other multi-sectoral platforms and other inter-ministerial collaborations that are critical to implement primary healthcare as well as universal health coverage. So it's basically going back to the basics, which is primary healthcare, that is healthcare at the last mile and the first point of contact for everybody.
So when we go back to the basics, as you mentioned, and we look at the African continent, what would you say are some of the major impediments to access to universal health coverage? I mean, there is a goal of by 2030, when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals, it's the targets are to be achieved by 2030. What can you tell us about where Africa stands and some of the major barriers to getting to achieving these goals?
Africa is a very diverse continent. Obviously, every country has its own challenges. We are talking about countries that may have a relatively stable to the most fragile and unstable context. Countries that are in conflict or post-conflict settings. And we know that a majority of population live in these kinds of context. And therefore, those basic things that one takes for granted, access to healthcare or the ability to live in a secure environment, are natural barriers for people in many parts of Africa, that including for healthcare workers, where healthcare workers' lives are in danger. And therefore, that becomes a big challenge. And therefore, building resilient health systems, how do you work with communities, the bottom up, to build resilient healthcare systems so that in times of crisis, that the health system is still able to withstand and offer basic healthcare services for people. That includes maternal child health and other adolescent-friendly healthcare services. And obviously, good governance is an important piece of it, which we know that in many contexts and countries, health governance is a major issue that needs to be fixed as well. We also are talking about access to skilled healthcare workers, which is a big barrier, either due to a lack of sufficient skilled healthcare workers or brain drain, or inability of healthcare workers to operate and live and work in extreme fragile contexts due to security and a host of other factors. So these are all real obstacles that are big barriers for us to achieve universal health coverage by 2030. So in other words, to achieve this, it is beyond the scope of just the health sector. It requires various other health systems to work together, including good governance and including making sure that policies are relevant for the local context and funding is suitable and appropriate and available for the local context. Everything has to be localized to the context for a program or an intervention to be effective. And also looking at local innovative solutions for healthcare service delivery. I think these are some of the greatest barriers. I mean, we know that now zero-dose children, for example, those who have not received any dose of vaccination is quite high in many countries. And so there is a concerted effort, whether it's from Gavi or other donors as well, to work with nonprofits and the government as well to identify where are those missed children and the zero dose children and to reach them, because we know that when that doesn't happen, outbreaks of illnesses such as measles or other vaccine preventable diseases are very common and it's happening all the time. So our goal is not just addressing the health, but looking at it from a holistic angle and finding solutions that can give a comprehensive response. That's what is needed.
It's a lot that it entails, that is involved clearly. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at the faith-based sector, we've seen during COVID, for example, that when there was an issue, whether it was access to vaccines or even vaccines, vaccine hesitancy, the faith-based community played a role during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, how would you describe the contribution of the faith-based sector on the journey towards universal health coverage?
Faith-based organizations and faith itself has a lot to offer in terms of advancing healthcare, whether it is respectful and compassionate healthcare or increasing access to healthcare. Let's take Africa, for example, where we did an assessment, a survey in 17 sub-Saharan African countries and assessed about 22 Christian health associations. And our study found that there are over 8,500 healthcare facilities that are managed and offered by Christian health associations that are often at the last mile. They include teaching hospitals, pharmacies, referral hospitals, and a host of other kind of healthcare facilities. That itself speaks about the volume and the contribution of faith-based organizations in terms of advancing health and primary health care. And in many countries in Africa, roughly 30 or even more percentage, up to 50 even, healthcare services are offered by faith-based organizations. During COVID, we know, and for other illnesses or practices, we know that faith plays an important part, for example, in vaccine hesitancy or in taking up certain evidence-based interventions and practices. So faith has a lot to offer. In most cases, in most countries, a large percentage of the population prescribe to one faith or the other. And therefore, not just giving scientific awareness of what is a good evidence-based intervention, but also connecting that to their faith is critical. Therefore, faith-sensitive messaging is important. For example, at Chorus International, we have a guide called the Sermon Guide, which is used to engage faith leaders and how to effectively transmit messages on key behaviors, whether it's COVID vaccine uptake or response to HIV, AIDS, and a host of other kinds of critical healthcare evidence-based interventions. So it's not just from a supply side and ability to treat people, but also from the demand side by engaging with people in a way that is sensitive to their faith and making it acceptable around the world, and especially in Africa. Faith-based organizations and faith-based leaders have a very critical role to play, including ensuring healthcare is compassionate and accessible.
Did the COVID-19 pandemic change or encourage some adjustments in terms of the way faith-based organizations work with their communities locally when it comes to healthcare and health access?
I mean, clearly what has happened is it has further validated the importance and the role that faith-based organizations have always played in the area of healthcare. This is fundamental to faith-based organizations, and their vision and mission is always about healing and healthcare. And that, I think, has been amplified during COVID as well as post-COVID right now. In terms of looking at what are some of the learnings that we have found and how do you incorporate that into the wider health service delivery. We also work with, for example, the Ecumenical Pharmaceutical Network, EPN, which is a pan-Africa-wide organization that works to improve access to essential medicines, drug supplies, pharmaceuticals, etc. So we have invested in them. We continue to work with them in a number of countries across Africa. The purpose of doing that is also making self-sustainable drug supply system in Africa. And that's the goal that EPN is working towards, quality, access to quality drugs and pharmaceuticals in Africa, produced in Africa too. So that's an interesting example that I can share. Post-COVID, the need for healthcare facilities to be well equipped with drugs and supplies, that one doesn't have to always be in a panic and resort to other countries. And that we saw during COVID, that was a major challenge. So there's one example of how one of the lessons we have learned and how we are intentionally and purposefully investing in African organizations, faith-based organizations, given what they already do, their capacity and strengths, and the wider reach that they have. But obviously also in terms of addressing a lot of the behavioral aspects as it pertains to improved access to healthcare or addressing the demand-side barriers of healthcare, that has become more critical than ever before. One thing is for sure, that the role of faith-based organizations and what they offer has been further validated during COVID and post-COVID.
Yes, and we've seen this, whether it was to help access, or some people were also talking about their faith in terms of vaccine hesitancy. So the role of the faith-based community is very critical. What are your thoughts about that, actually?
I mean, definitely it is important. We know that faith played a major role in vaccine hesitancy too, by the way, in terms of people not wanting to take vaccine for a number of belief systems that they have. But countering that requires an evidence-based approach that ties evidence-based and faith aspects, so, and working with faith leaders. And so that is what happened and continues to happen as well, especially during COVID and post-COVID. I mentioned about working, addressing, for example, zero-dose vaccine. In other words, children who have not received any dose of vaccination. We know where those pockets are, and they are in the most restricted, and especially in the most fragile context. But we also know that they are often in restricted contexts where faith plays an important element. Therefore, to reach that unreached population, working through faith leaders has become more than ever important. And if you see it, various donor guidelines, they emphasize the aspects of working through faith leaders, for example, in terms of reaching those populations that have not reached. And those vaccine hesitancies are not just Africa, or, I mean, around the world we have seen, whether it's Asia, Africa, or even in most developed countries like the United States, where faith was a big barrier.
Okay.
But it's also an enabler.
Okay, and any final thoughts before we let you go, Dr. Chirion?
Well, I definitely want to say that this is an important time in our global healthcare. But investing in primary healthcare is what is fundamental if we are to achieve universal health coverage by 2030, which itself is a challenging task given the context that we live in, but also good governance and engaging local actors to find local solutions is key. Okay. That's what we at Chorus International are committed to.
Okay, Dr. Dennis Chirion, thank you so much. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you for your time and for the opportunity.
That was Dr. Dennis Chirion, Vice President of Chorus International for Health, Nutrition, and WASH. Now, the UN Environmental Assembly, known as UNEA6, is meeting in Nairobi this week to chart solutions to the triple planetary crisis of climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution. Juma Majanga reports from the UN Environment Headquarters in Nairobi.
Over 7,000 delegates from across the world, including heads of state, ministers, intergovernmental organizations, civil society groups, the scientific community, and private sector, are gathered here in Nairobi to discuss and shape global environmental policy.
There is no objection. It is so decided.
Founded in 2012, the UN Environment Assembly brings together all the 193 UN member states with the aim of fostering multilateral solutions to global environmental challenges. This is the sixth session of the Assembly.
Today, in 2024, the international community is looking to us to deliver. This is our moment to advance the global environmental agenda.
Previous UNEA meetings have produced more than 90 resolutions on various global environmental issues.
It is time to lay political differences aside, time to focus on this little blue planet, this little planet that is teeming with life, and lift our sights to the common goal, securing a pathway to a future that is safe and sustainable.
The meeting of the world's highest environmental decision-making body comes at a time when there has been an increase in the effects of climate change, especially in Africa, despite the continent producing fewer carbon emissions than any other. Kenya is one of the countries still recovering from the effects of a deadly record drought in the Horn of Africa. The government says the assembly in Nairobi brings hope.
At this UNEA 6, we have the singular opportunity to inject optimism and restore faith in a strengthened global environmental governance system underpinned by science-based multilateral diplomacy.
International discussions on environmental issues are often influenced by political undertones that analysts say can impact such talks, with more than 60 countries, including the U.S., heading to the polls this year. Environmentalists are bracing for wide-ranging outcomes. In a response to a VOA question during a news conference, the UNEP boss expressed her optimism in voters' decision.
I hope that when people go into the voting booth, that they will take the future with them in their heart and their grandchild or their daughter or son with them in their hand. Because when we vote, we are not just voting for today, we are also voting for tomorrow. And tomorrow is where the environment either is vibrant or not.
Environment leaders agree that UNEA 6 cannot solve the planet's environmental problems overnight. They are nevertheless hopeful that the assembly will help focus minds and energies on finding solutions. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Kenya.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, with producer Mukbili Abaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.